You're on the Front Porch, where we tackle the tough issues facing Appalachia the same way you and your friends do, on your front porch. This week, we're talking about the true cost of drug addiction to West Virginia's economy. A new study says the state devotes, get this, 12% of its economy to dealing with the epidemic. I'm Scott Finn, the Grand Poobah here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, joined, as always, by liberal columnist Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
And our other front porch regular, Jesse Troyan, is gone this week. Rick, you know where she is?
I think she's in rodeo school this week.
Jesse has wisely suggested that her boss, Garrett Ballingy, take her place. Garrett is the Grand Poobah of the Free Market Cardinal Institute. Hey, Garrett.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me back.
Let's talk about this study, which I read in the Charleston Gazette Mail. They're not just an underwriter of the Front Porch. They're also a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Opioid epidemic costs West Virginia $8.8 billion annually. Putting it into perspective, that means 12% of West Virginia's gross domestic product, that's everything that we create economically, goes to dealing with the costs of the epidemic, according to a study by the American Enterprise Institute, which is a conservative think tank at the national level. That seems like a lot.
The study cited West Virginia the highest burden per resident. It was nearly $5,000 of cost as a result of the opioid epidemic. And so I just started thinking, what does that actually mean? What does that mean to a community? What does that mean to a family who perhaps whose dad is no longer in the household, who's not bringing in that kind of money? What kind of extra stress does that put on churches and other civil society organizations? You know, I think I've reached a point of sort of saturation on the opioid discussion. But for whatever reason, this study really kind of brought it home to me and got me thinking about the breadth, the depth, and the magnitude of what we're facing as a state. Especially because when you look at the comparison on this, if you want to quibble about the numbers, that's one thing. But we are, relatively speaking, so much more burdened by this than anyone else in the country. To me, it's just really stark. Maryland, I think, was second as far as highest burden per resident, yet they were only at $3,300 and we're almost at $5,000. You look at Nebraska, a state with a very similar population to West Virginia, just under 2 million people, they were at $450 a person. I don't believe in this sort of thing, but sometimes you think West Virginia's cursed. But like, to me, it just really brought home the magnitude of what we're facing as a state compared to maybe some of our neighbors in other states.
The thing that I'd be interested in tracking down is the other side of it. I'd like to track down how much in profits drug companies made on West Virginia by pill bombing it. Like, yeah, how much did somebody get rich off Kermit's misery? Eric Ayers' study of the millions and millions of pills. I'd love to follow the money out.
There's a lot of money being spent around the opioid epidemic. There's money spent by addicts. There's money spent in treatment. But is there some sort of effect where the economy starts to depend on an epidemic and non-productive activities like dealing with addiction? It replaces what should be productive activity, building businesses, educating ourselves. You know, I kind of worry about an economy that's built largely now on dealing with an addiction.
There's something related to that, which is opportunity cost, which is something that you hear economists talk a lot about, which is basically for whatever activity you're doing or you're engaged in, what is the next best use of your time? Like, what are you actually giving up? If you're sitting here interviewing Rick and I, what is the value of what you could be doing elsewhere, right? And so whenever we have an economy that is increasingly dealing with this type of thing, you really begin to see that in the numbers where if a person is at rehab, they're not working. And so like the AEI study tries to take that type of thing into account. What kind of productivity are we losing, not only in the moment, but if you add in something like the fatal aspect of this, what kind of productivity are we losing 30 or 40 years from now when this person's no longer around? And so I think based on my understanding, that's what the AEI study tried to do. They took data from the CDC and then also the White House Council of Economic Advisors, threw in the per state variation on something like opioid overdose death rates, and then tried to get a distributive effects and distributive estimates on how that impacts things.
Well, so my point in this is about what's on the agenda in the state. Here we are in the legislature, and they're spending a lot of energy and time talking about rising PEIA costs, and whether to give a 1% or 2% or 3% raise to state workers and teachers. And look, these are important issues to folks that are affected by that. I'm not saying that. But meanwhile, I feel like it's kind of like arguing about dividing up the pie when the pie is on fire.
I think spending time on single delegate districts is kind of like wasting time. I don't really see teacher pay is a minor issue. I think it's pretty huge for a lot of people here. But the point that where are the priorities? I mean, what are we doing putting on the ballot for constitutional amendments? What kind of things are distracting people from dealing with bigger problems?
Why aren't we talking about this every single day?
This is a hard thing to solve. There's no plan. There's no silver bullet to this, right, which is something that politicians inherently gravitate towards. There's no plan that I've seen that, like, with any degree of certainty would really alleviate this kind of problem writ large. And so they do focus on these other things that they could go back and say, we've done something. Whereas on something like the opioid epidemic, the quote, done something may not manifest for 10, 15, 20 years from now. So what incentive do they have to tackle this?
We had Lois Vance from Cabin Creek, who is on here, who works with people in recovery. I mean, there are things that work, and a lot of people through Medicaid expansion have gotten treatment. I mean, I know people who are working now, taking care of their kids, going to school. So there is a way out.
It's hard. And I think Garrett's getting to the point that the political payoff may not be immediate enough for politicians to really work on this as hard as we'd like. I'm going to shill a little bit for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. We're partnering with Elaine McMillian Sheldon, who is the filmmaker who did the documentary Heroin, that's with an E on the end, that has been nominated for an Oscar. That documentary focuses on three women in Huntington who are helping to fight the opioid epidemic. We're going to be showing this on February 15th at the University of Charleston at 6 p.m., free and open to the public. Please come. Elaine will be there. Jen Rader, who is the fire chief in Huntington, West Virginia, who's in the documentary, she'll be there. People who deal with addiction will be there. So invite you to come and stick around. There's going to be a conversation afterwards. And again, this is part of our effort here in West Virginia Public Broadcasting to make 2018 the year that we start to turn things around with the opioid epidemic. And next week, we're going to have Dr. Michael Brummage on, who is the new drug czar for the state of West Virginia and a friend of ours. So stay and listen to that. We know what the problem is. Then what are some of the solutions? Give me one each and I'll give one.
To me, I've always maintained that drug addiction of any type is a symptom of hopelessness. And I think one of the best ways that you can alleviate that is to give people a sense of purpose. You give people a sense of responsibility. And I think the best way to do that is a healthy economy. People are going to work. They have routines. They have responsibilities to folks around them. They feel like they have responsibilities to their community. And so I think if you get that kind of thing going and you get it in place, we're going to see a precipitous drop in these kinds of issues. You know, I think our opioid epidemic is probably in some way, frankly, related to one of the things we always talk about is we've had the lowest labor force participation rate since the 1970s. Maybe this is partially some of that coming home to roost in a real, real human way.
Speaking of the market, I mean, think of all the companies that really use the market to cash in on West Virginia's opioid addiction problem. So that's the other side of that. And again, when you're looking at these things, look at the question, who benefits? I do think people need access to good education. They need workforce training. They need access to healthcare and treatment if that's an option that they need. Those are not necessarily things the market's going to provide.
Okay, and here's my pitch. I think it's about understanding and communication. There are broad misconceptions about what causes addiction, how it's treated, and how people can recover from it that need to be tackled. Orion Strategies just last month did a poll of West Virginians, and they asked a couple of really interesting questions. One is addiction a moral failing mostly, or is it a medical condition mostly? And it was pretty evenly split between people who said it's a medical condition and it's a moral failing. Now, not to say that people's choices don't lead you down the road of addiction. I'm not saying there's no moral aspect to it. But most scientists agree that two people can start taking a drug. And if you're predisposed to addiction in your body and your brain, you're going to become addicted. Whereas the other person might be able to take a drug and then not get addicted. That's a medical condition. And then the other question was about how to treat it. And again, there was this split between people who said abstinence is the only way to treat opioid addiction versus people who said, no, you could have this medically assisted treatment, which is like the different drugs that you take to wean yourself off of it. The science is really clear that usually for most people, the best way is a slow sort of drawing away from the addiction, not the immediate sort of cutoff of abstinence.
So, you know, speaking of the moral thing, there's an idea that people talk about in philosophy and sometimes social science of moral luck, that a lot of what happens to us is a matter of luck, whether you live in a certain country at a certain time, whether you're from a certain class, affects what movements you might get caught up into, what generation you're in, being in the wrong place at the wrong time, genetic susceptibility. So luck is a big factor, even in a lot of where we wind up with moral decisions, too.
Of course, this is like not an either or, never an either or thing. And one of the big differences philosophically between liberals and conservatives is that conservatives tend to think more about moral choices and individual responsibility. And liberals tend to think more about the situation you're born in and effects that you don't have control over. And I hate to be a wishy-washy person on this, but I think that it's a mixture of the two.
At a certain age, I probably would have tried anything, seriously. I was just lucky that growing up along the Mud River, there wasn't...
I thought you did try anything.
No. There was a point, though, where I probably would have. The other thing that just to throw in there, some British epidemiologists wrote a book a while back called The Spirit Level, and they look at overall issues. They tend to find in societies that have greater inequality, you tend to have more of these problems. And it's interesting, some countries with low inequality have heavy state intervention, but other countries like Japan have a lot of equality, and that's not due to redistribution or anything, it's a cultural thing. But inequality tends to make problems like this worse, it reduces social trust, it has a lot of big effects.
I would be curious to know if it's simply wealth inequality, or, and maybe this doesn't matter, maybe it's a distinction without a difference, but if we're honest, wealthier people tend to have greater kind of support networks around them, right? Or they have sort of cushions that allow them to weather blows that if they were to happen to a lower income person, they would not be able to weather. We had an event in September with the American Conservative Union, and we had a woman there who talked about her fight with opioid addiction and those types of things. The difference was she worked at the White House. She would obviously had been very successful. She was a successful woman that lived over in the Eastern Panhandle, and her sons had dealt with this issue. The difference between somebody like that and somebody that lives down in Williamson or Logan County or something like that is she has the resources to be able to help her kids weather that type of blow. And so I do not dispute the inequality argument, but I'm wondering if it's something else is there. And maybe this could be a broader kind of atomization of society kind of discussion or something like that, how we are kind of in our little silos.
From what I've seen, another epidemiologist, Michael Marmot, looked at it, and he suggests two main factors. One is a sense of autonomy and control you have over your life, and the other is the ability to fully participate in the society in which you live, which is where relative inequality matters. And people say, well, poor people have DVD players. Yeah, well, but part of how you measure yourself, Adam Smith even says that, for a person to have a respectable suit of clothes, to be able to participate in the things in society. So when you don't have those, that kicks up the stress level and can have a lot of different health effects too.
So I go back to when I went to Nicaragua. I went up to this village that was up in the mountains, and they were what we would call desperately poor. I stayed in a house with a couple, young couple, two young kids. They slept in hammocks. They had a clean house, but it was very small, two rooms. They grew most of their own food. In this community, they had banded together, and they had their own garden. They built their own school. They were in the process of building their own water system. And what we did, we were a church group that came down and brought the pipe. And then we were going to, quote unquote, help them, but they did all the hard work. They carried these huge pipes up the mountain, dug the trenches by hand so they could have water for their community. And there was a sense of pride, and there was a sense of progress there. And every person in that village had less money and stuff than people on Big Ugly Creek, which is where I was working at the time here in West Virginia. And yet there are a lot of people on Big Ugly that did not have the sense of mission and purpose and in their life. And I think a part of that is relative poverty, relative position. People in Nicaragua are comparing themselves against other Nicaraguans, but there's also a sense of work. These people had a sense of purpose and work that some folks on Big Ugly had lost. They didn't have a job necessarily. Maybe they're making income from SSI or these other programs to survive, even to have satellite TV and things that their parents didn't have. But they'd lost that sense of purpose. So I think, I hate to keep doing this, but I think you're both right. I think if I have to pick the worst of the two, I think inequality is bad. I think there's evidence of that's true. But I think what's worse is the lack of work. People who used to have a job path and lost it, I think that's a lot more damaging.
That's driven inequality.
You know, one of the things that's well documented is a decline in church attendance in the United States, for example, and that's happened a lot in low-income communities. And so a lot of times what would happen is if you have some sort of health crisis or work crisis or something like that, you are able to sort of band together with your fellow churchgoers or your members of the community lodge or whatever it was, and you are able to kind of get your way out of that using resources and the help of other people in the community. So I wonder if inequality becomes more of an issue if you're also more socially isolated, right? Like you're not going down to the bingo hall. You're not a member of the Moose Lodge or the Knights of Columbus or something like that.
Or your union got decimated, you know. But that's the whole Robert Putnam thing about social capital and its decline in America.
Interesting, interesting conversation. And we're going to continue it next week with Dr. Michael Brummage. He is the new, I think it's called the Governor's Office of Drug Policy. I'm going to call him the drug czar. So much easier.
Well, czar has certain connotations.
Yeah, so I'm never been a big fan of that.
Okay. Oh, well, I know.
People's commissar, you know, or something like that. Maybe. Oh, wow.
Let's say he's a drug grand poobah, just to keep it consistent in front porchian. If you have opinions about how to fight the opioid crisis, let me know. Send me an email to sfinn@wvpublic.org or direct message me on Twitter @RadioFinn or to Rick if you'd rather reach out to Rick and tell him how wrong he is and how socialist. What's your Twitter handle again?
@ElCabrera.
All right. Or Garrett, yours is?
G Ballenge.
How do you spell that?
G-B-A-L-L-E-N-G.
Okay. That's Garrett Ballenge. He's the grand poobah of the Cardinal Institute, the Free Market Institute here in Charleston, West Virginia. Thank you for coming on. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And then Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee. And Rick, do you have any words of wisdom and or Bible verse this week?
To those who have, more shall be given. To those who have not, even the little they have shall be taken away. I think I've used that one before. That's from the Gospels.
Let's, and Billie Holiday, if I remember right, too. This is Scott Finn, Grand Poobah, West Virginia Public Broadcasting, signing off on the front porch. Thanks for listening.
Them that's God shall get, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible said, and it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own, that's got his own. Yes, the strong gets more, while the weak ones fade. Empty pockets don't ever make the grave. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless.